Today in Focus is the new daily podcast from The Guardian. Every weekday, you'll hear a different side to the news from those at the heart of the story. Today in Focus brings you personal stories and fresh perspectives so you get a deeper understanding of the world. Subscribe now to make sure you don't miss the first episode. Listen to Today in Focus and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere you listen to podcasts.
The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Jessica Elgott. So Theresa May lives to fight another day, again. A week ago, things weren't looking too good for the Prime Minister. After a disappointing EU summit, Tory MPs briefed saying that May was now entering the killing zone and that she should bring her own noose to the next backbenchers meeting. Rumours were swirling in Westminster that there would finally be a confidence vote. Yesterday, the Prime Minister had to face down her critics at the Tory party's 1922 committee. But the meeting went better than expected and May emerged with her job safe, for now. But for how long can she continue to survive in her own hostile environment? Also this week, can recognising patterns from history help us avoid conflict today? EU policy advisor and academic Jonathan Holzlag distills 3,000 years of history into the 656 pages of his book, A Political History of the World, to find out.
We are exiting a period of peace and we are returning to the normal nature of international politics.
But first, Theresa May's Hell Week was supposed to be a few weeks ago, but it seems like she never left it. If anything, she descended several circles and things became even hotter last week. She may have survived yesterday's 1922 committee, but in a poll published the same day, just 19% of Tory supporters said they had confidence in May's handling of Brexit. So what does the future hold for the embattled Prime Minister? I'm joined to discuss by my expert panel, Michael White, the former political editor of The Guardian, Katie Balls from The Spectator, and down the line from Westminster, our political sketchwriter John Crace, the author of The Maybot, The Rise and Fall. So at the tail end of last week, we had Tory MP Johnny Mercer saying he wouldn't vote for his own party and had no interest in becoming a minister or serving under the current Prime Minister, which seems an extraordinary thing to say on the outside. But I mean, Katie, first, was Johnny just saying what other people are thinking in the party about the state of it?
Yeah, I think Johnny Mercer was saying what a lot of MPs are thinking at the moment. Morale is very low. He did try and clarify his comments later, but in a way it was quite a funny clarification because he said he stood by his comments comparing the current administration to an excrement show. But he, I'm not going to swear on this podcast, but he didn't say that he wouldn't vote for his own party. He just said that had, you know, this be a Johnny Mercer who was not in Parliament, he probably wouldn't vote for them, which is a slight difference. But it's interesting that in the current climate, you need to make these things clear. But I think it's just symptomatic of the fact that across the Tory party, people are very annoyed right now. They don't feel very motivated, but it's all for very different reasons. So Johnny Mercer's problem is he doesn't feel there's an uplifting, aspiring agenda. But you'll speak to another MP and they don't like the Brexit approach. Speak to another MP, they don't like the Brexit approach either, but for a completely different reason. So it's a very jumbled range of opinions, but overall the unifying feeling is not being very happy.
Yeah, and that unifying feeling, it doesn't necessarily translate into wanting to immediately remove the Prime Minister for a lot of them, even if they don't find it very inspiring. And I was outside the 1922 last night and I asked one MP, well, you know, did the Prime Minister say anything memorable when she addressed the Committee of Tory MPs? And he said, no, of course she didn't. So that's basically the feeling, I think, across a lot of MPs. But does that mean they really want to get her? And things turned pretty nasty over the weekend when, you know, there was a assassination is in the air, is one of the quotes. And there's a sort of particularly lurid quote about the knife being heated and stuck in her front and she'll be dead soon. I mean, Michael, is it new to use this kind of language about a Prime Minister, about a party leader?
Well, the vehemence of it and the violence of the imagery, which is pretty disgraceful a year or so after Joe Cox was murdered, I think that's worse. But you can always find some self-opinionated junior backbencher. We never call them junior. They're always senior, aren't they? You can always find some fool to shoot his mouth off. Tim Shipman of the Sunday Times, who quoted that stuff, pretty smart fella, but I thought he was slightly out of order to do that. And even President Trump has noticed overnight that if you use that language as much as he does, people start sending bombs. So I don't like it, but it's always been around. Whether it would have got in the papers, years ago. I doubt it. It's, you know, it's pretty crude stuff.
It seems to perhaps have been something that ended up having the opposite effect. Do you think that's right, John? Did you think that, did it feel when you were watching PMQs yesterday that there was, you know, at least some sort of muted support for the Prime Minister?
Well, I think it was sort of certainly noticeable that she was getting an easy ride from her own backbenchers. I suspect that at the time she was more concerned about what the Tories might say to her than anything that Jeremy Corbyn might throw at her. But I suspect also that the Tories keep looking into the abyss and not seeing any possible replacement. I mean, it's all very well to say you've got, want to get rid of her, but you need to have a plan B. And as far as I can see, there isn't any obvious person in the sidelines waiting to take over, or certainly no one who would get through a majority of the Tory party MPs or even the membership.
Katie, do you think that some of the sort of more disturbing stuff that happened over the weekend actually helped the Prime Minister?
Yeah, I think it did help her, to the point that you even had a very vocal Theresa May critic in the form of Andrew Bridgen actually suggest that Number 10 had planted the quotes themselves. I don't think anyone thinks there's a chance that is the case, but it does show the fact that there is a Eurosceptic faction who realise that since that quote went out there, there's been an effort by the MPs to rally around Theresa May. And I think that's because, again, you have a very divided party, as John has just mentioned. They can't agree on much. There was a feeling that they were losing, you know, a faith in the way the negotiations were going, Theresa May's handling. But then they start to see these quotes, and they're a group of probably, you could say, more moderate. It seems to be a controversial word these days. You know, more domestically minded, not particularly EU-minded MPs who were edging towards siding perhaps the Eurosceptics. They see those quotes and they go, well, I don't want to be associated with a group who are, you know, so who are coming up with such violent language and actually seem quite nasty. So I think that is part of the reason this week you have seen people go, actually, you know what, she might be uninspiring, she might be in many ways a bit rubbish, but, you know, she's not offensive.
in some ways, this is a reprise of John Major's trouble in the 90s, which I went through. People weren't as nasty as we've all agreed, but Major just staggered on. He was challenged by John Redwood. Well, that was a missed opportunity, wasn't it? But he remained Prime Minister until he lost the next election. But he was up against Tony Blair, so different equation. But it feels the same.
It does
they don't
feel the
have
same.
A policy and they don't have a candidate. They, you know, there is no agreed policy in the, among his critics, and they don't have a candidate. Not that they can. They want to rally behind you, Boris Johnson.
So they're falling into the same traps, if you like, as might have, if they've studied history, they might have.
Some of them are the same
avoided.
People.
<They're> just, yes, they are.
The definition of madness to keep repeating the same experiment and expect a different result.
Like, who's the most dangerous faction in the Tory parties? Because there are the sort of ERG types. There's the people around David Davis. There's also the people around Boris Johnson. Those two fat camps definitely don't seem to trust each other or like each other. Then you also have opponents within the cabinet. You have those Tory Remainers who are the ones who are the only ones, don't forget, that have actually defeated the government on any legislation. So who's the most dangerous to her?
I don't see any serious strategists in the ERG. They're mainly amateur night at the prom. Boris, deep down, he's shallow. Same with Davis, egotist, attention seeker. The faction to watch is Michael Gove. Trust me, Gove. He's got her back at the moment, how long he keeps it, but he's the one playing a long game. You sense with Gove, he's only a journalist, for God's sake, but he has a strategic brain and he's crafty. Watch Gove. He's the rascal to watch.
When you look at the Parliament tribes, I think the most dangerous one is actually one that we don't talk about that much, is the big group. Been quite out of luck recently, which is the Stop Banging On About Europe group. They didn't really want to have this referendum in the first place. They're not particularly ideologically attached either way, but they are sizable. And if this group decide that they have lost faith in Theresa May's ability to lead the negotiations, to make decisions, that is such a large chunk that she would lose a confidence vote and there would be trouble.
We're talking about, you know, the result of removing a prime minister. There is actually a mechanism for doing that, which is that you have to, there's a lot of talk about, you know, we need 48 letters to Sir Graham Brady. He's the only one who knows what they are, although some journalists say they know what it is. And that triggers a no confidence vote if he receives that sort of critical number. And he says he hasn't even told his wife how many he's received. Do you think we'll ever get there? And if we do ever get there, What's the moment for it to happen? Is it now? Is it straight after the Brexit talks conclude? When is it, Katie?
Well, I think, I mean, this is an evergreen story, isn't it? I was looking through because I think Theresa May has been reported as being perilously close to the 48 letters required for this confidence vote for over a year now. I think what is likely to happen, and there are some reports that perhaps Graham Brady can't count, or he's willfully doing bad mathematics on this because we keep hearing letters going in. If I think there are 48 MPs who are really, more than 48, who are really unhappy with Theresa May, but they don't currently think that they could win a confidence vote. So if people want to make the vote happen, they can. I think the point when you might start to see it happening is we know that Theresa May doesn't want to do any big concessions until the budget is out of the way, because she doesn't want the budget on Monday to be able to be weaponized by people in the DUP, even her own Brexiteer MPs, as a way to, you know, bring down the government, or at least threaten to. I think once you're out of the way on that, you might start to see the government moving in ways that are very unpalatable to parts of the party. And if that spreads past just the European Research Group of Eurosceptic backbenchers and to a larger chunk, and this group start to think, actually, we could get over 150 MPs saying they don't have confidence in May, then it could happen. But I still think that's a big if.
Do you think, Michael, that there's a risk that Tory rebels and perhaps with the DUP see the budget next week as a moment to try and take down the Prime Minister or force a change of direction?
Well, they could if they were serious, but I watch this from a distance now. I feel I've seen the movie so many times before. I don't have to watch the screen. I don't have to sit in the press gallery. It's the same but different. I don't think they've got the bottle to do it, because they don't have a candidate who could get elected, certainly not through MPs. I'm not even sure Mogg is serious, and Boris, by definition, is never serious. You can't say that too often. So I don't think they'll bring it down on the budget, because supply in the Victorian constitution books is absolutely central, and a government might fall and God knows what might happen. And don't forget their ace, May's ace, is really Jeremy Corbyn. So I doubt it. Now, when did this happen last? Well, Thatcher was brought down. Major survived. In 1989, the rules were different. It only needed, I think, three MPs to trigger a leadership contest. A man nobody had ever heard of called Anthony Mayer, old Etonian, pro-European, moderate, nice old boy, stood against her. He lost, of course, but he got 70 or 80 votes. It was never the same for her again. And a year later, Geoffrey Howe resigned, Heseltine came after her, and she went. So you never know when you pull the brick out of the system. One last point. The Tories believe in the leadership principle, the Führer Prinzip, as I believe the Germans put it. You get a leader, and if they screw up, you get rid of them. And, you know, they've got rid of an awful lot in my lifetime. Eden, Macmillan, Heath, brutally. Thatcher, in the end, the great election winner. Hagen, Duncan Smith, they were duds. You know, Labour never does it, because Labour believes in kind of collective leadership. John McDonnell's really the leader of the Labour Party. Jeremy's the Queen. But, you know, they're not going to move against him, because they never do, literally have never putched a leader in the way that the Tories often do, because it's a different principle of leadership.
John, somehow May just kind of carries on, doesn't she? I think that you and I were discussing once about how if you and I were in charge and had to give that press conference after the last EU summit, we'd just both be gibbering wrecks. And yet she sometimes carries on. She's kind of indestructible in that way, which might make her less susceptible to leadership challenges than some other leaders. Do you admire anything about that aspect of her personality?
I think it's hard not to admire her sheer sort of bloody-minded stubbornness and resilience. I mean, not least because she gives every sign of actually hating the job she's doing, and almost of giving signs that she's aware of the fact that she's doing a bad job badly. But she has this sort of ability to keep going, which, I mean, I certainly wouldn't be able to do. I would kind of...
No, you wouldn't.
I would look in the mirror and think, this is just too much. Just let somebody else have a go. It's an impossible job. I mean, I do believe that Brexit is near to anything as impossible, because to get the deal that would actually get through Parliament, there doesn't seem to be any options left on the table. And I don't really see how she can do it. So I think she must wake up every morning just thinking, how does this work? How does this work? But I suspect that she gets through by just sort of lowering her sights and sort of just taking every day on a minute-by-minute basis.
Katie, she wrote a piece in The Sun where she said that she'd once been asked by a journalist, how are you doing, Prime Minister? And that she suggested that she wished she'd thought of a better answer, which is, it's not about how I'm doing, it's just about the national interests. And do you think that kind of, that part of her personality is a thing that would make her less likely to go under pressure?
I think she does what she thinks is for the public good. I think she is, in a way, a civil servant type of leader. And at times that can be a good thing, all over the detail, but at times it does leave people in her party a bit exasperated because they want, you know, big ideas and so forth. It also has meant she has stuck around doing a difficult job in a way that some of her predecessors haven't. But I think in general, and I mean, we don't know what she herself says privately. We know that what those around her say. I think she probably does accept that she is not going to lead the party into the next election unless something drastic changes. So I do think there is a feeling in number 10 that her big job here is to just get to March, get something through on Brexit, and then just see what happens next, which means that I think when you saw that Sun article where she was basically said, I'm not going to move aside, I'm doing what I think is best for the country, I don't think she is that bothered about what it does to her political capital. And that's partly because she isn't so interested in her own standing, but also because she just sees that it's her job to get through this. And I don't think that you're going to see her try and run for, you know, two more elections after that.
Katie, what are the kind of flashpoints coming up over the next kind of 2 to 3 months leading up to that date in March where she could be pushed out? Or is now the most dangerous time? Is it too late otherwise?
Well, I think there's some people who think it's too late even now. And that's part of the reason that she is still in place. There is a feeling amongst the Eurosceptics that they dropped the ball, so to speak, that they kind of presumed Theresa May was going for this harder Brexit. By the time they realised what was really happening, by the time they'd actually read what had been agreed in December,
6 months,
exactly, it was a bit too late to do anything drastic. Obviously, it's never good to make a prediction so close to the actual event, so I've got to be careful what I say about the budget. But I think the fact that there haven't been any big concessions ahead of this budget means the budget shouldn't really be the danger point some people thought it would be a month ago. I think what is going to get difficult for Theresa May is if this, you know, impasse in the negotiations sticks, if there is no real progress on the backstop, she either has to make a concession of something which the DUP would find completely unpalatable, of a Northern Ireland specific backstop and a lot of her party, the Scottish Conservatives, or she's got to start putting in all the motions of no deal planning. And I think both of those decisions would risk resignations in the cabinet, but also a big backbench rally on either side of her party. So I don't think from there it's a specific thing, but it does come a point by which if we are heading to no deal, the government really has to say they are. So I think that's when it might start to come to a head.
I think it's impossible to predict how it'll go from here. Deal, no deal, May, no May. General election, probably not. Second referendum, almost certainly not. It's almost impossible to say. Tell you what, May reminds me a bit of Angela Merkel. Conscientious Protestant clergyman's daughters. May's an only child. She has no children, nor does Merkel, as it happens. Rather very, very cautious people, bit uninspiring. Of course, Merkel's won 3-4 elections now as she's on her way out. But there's a kind of tenacity, dogged tenacity. It's not about ego with May, is it, dear Lord? She just feels she ought to try and do her best to get it through. And if she does, by hook or by crook, and this is a complete disaster for which we can blame plenty of other people, you know, she'll come out of this looking strangely solid, honourable. It won't be, if she can get us through this without the country plunging into economic recession, civil war and all the other horror stories, we won't look back on her as unkindly as John Crace does every day.
Last one, John, do you think, is there anything she can do to rescue her legacy? Is she the Maybot given the impossible task? Will that be the thing on her tombstone, or is there anything she can do that to revive her reputation?
I have to disagree with Mike here, because I think that her legacy is sort of written, and I think she kind of knows that. And I don't think we will look back kindly on her. I mean, partly because I think that the only deal that she can bring back is one that everybody dislikes. it'll be a deal that the Remainers hate because they think it's not what we signed up for. And it'll probably be a deal that the Leavers don't think is what they signed up for. And I kind of think that her image of the Maybot has sort of become part of a public conversation. I mean, I started it in jest, but I mean, now you just hear it all used colloquially on the radio by almost everyone as a sort of byline for her. And it, I think it has become symbolic of someone who is sort of dogged, slightly out of touch and sort of remote and with a sort of air of faint incompetence attached.
And on that note, thank you ever so much to all of my guests, Katie Balls, Michael White, John Crace. You can find out more and read all our political coverage on theguardian.com. Now, what can 3,000 years of war and peace teach us about avoiding conflict today? That's what Jonathan Holzlag, EU policy advisor and teacher of international politics at the Free University of Brussels, attempts to find out in his new book, A Political History of the World, taking in everything from ancient Egypt to the creation of the United Nations. The book looks for broad patterns in war, diplomacy and power across different eras and regions and asks what lessons we can learn from the past. Jonathan joins me now. Jonathan, what inspired you to write the book? Was there some fact or moment that particularly piqued your interest?
Well, first of all, the world is getting quite a scary place. There is the nationalism of Donald Trump. There is China's military muscle flexing. There is Russia rearming. We have authoritarian states going after journalists. And I think when we exit an age of predictability, of peace and stability, it's particularly necessary to get to grips with history and to try to draw some lessons from past eras of power politics.
Although we're living in a sort of, it feels like an unprecedented time of upheaval in geopolitics, but then conversely you get people arguing that, in fact, the world has never been so peaceful, people have never been so prosperous. In fact, we're living in a time of unprecedented growth and wealth for the vast majority of people on the planet. Is that true that we're living in the best times ever, or is it just a sort of pattern of backwards and forwards?
Well, to a large extent, I agree with the optimist that history is by and large an upward trajectory. Prosperity has increased, the world has become safer, certainly in our very tiny corner of the world in Europe. It's a marvelous place to live. That said, it's an upward curve, but it comes with a lot of setbacks. Periods of prosperity and peace are often followed by periods of more uncertainty. And I think what we see around us, again, is the world becoming normal, like the nationalism, the pursuit of power, the blatant pursuit of power and influence. That's something that has characterized world politics during or throughout most of history. So we are exiting a period of peace and we are returning to, let's say, the normal nature of international politics.
So a leader like Donald Trump, with a kind of a America first approach, a very kind of bombastic approach, is more of a norm historically than perhaps some of the, I guess, more liberal leaders that we might have seen in recent years in Europe.
That's true. Liberalism often basically reflects strength. Liberalism and the emphasis on free trade usually reflects a dominant position of a society in world politics. When you're strong, you can afford yourself to be open. When you're strong, you also have an interest in unlocking other foreign markets to your own economy. What we witness today is that those countries that used to be strong, let's say by and large the Euro-Atlantic world, Europe and the United States, now are on the defensive. And what we see is that they are backtracking from their own liberal principles, the United States, but I think also the United Kingdom, for instance, with a decision to exit the European Union. So the retreat from liberalism, I think, is a sort of reflection of a shift in the balance of power. We see now that the West is losing power and influence compared to, for instance, China and others, and that leads to defensiveness.
It's often argued that because we live in such a globalized, by and large, capitalist world where there are such concrete trading links between so many nations, that makes sort of future conflicts far more difficult. But to phenomena like Brexit, and, you know, as you might, I guess, in Europe, you see rise of authoritarian leaders, maybe like Hungary's Viktor Orban. Does that sort of challenge that narrative a bit?
One of the ideas that the book, I think, quite forcefully debunks is that trade and globalization inevitably brings cooperation and peace. We have seen many, many occasions at which there was a, let's say, spreading of trade relations. But then the reaction of countries, of major powers, is not to let trade be free, but to try to control it. In the book, for instance, there is the example of all the nations along the ancient Silk Road, not just trying to advance trade, but also trying to tax trade and to use trade to propagate their influence. There is, of course, empire building in Persia, where you had Persian emperors building roads, advancing maritime trade, but on their own terms. So when we see the advancing of trade, you also see the advancing of political influence. That's one thing. Then also when you have trade growing, and certainly when it leads to the increase of economic power of one particular nation, it leads to uncertainty, envy and distrust amongst other nations. When trade coincides with a shift of the balance of power, it leads to competition, to protectionism, and hence also to more instability.
And does that tend to be a sort of a pattern of popular reaction against those kind of trading links that you might get? Have we sort of seen similar popular uprising against and towards nationalism from peoples or societies in the past, as we've seen potentially in Trump's America and also over here?
Well, you see a backlash against trade and globalization when it coincides with inequality. One of the big causes of instability throughout world politics, as I try to also point out in the book, is internal injustice and inequality. And we have seen that again and again and again. In ancient Roman times, for instance, one of the main causes of the downfall of the empire and also its inability to defend itself against what it called the barbarians was the fact that at the pinnacle of the society, you had this decadent imperial elite living in lush golden and marble palaces, while on the other hand you had vast masses of poverty that didn't feel part of this imperial success story. As a result, it started to crumble. So globalization and trade, that's fine, but as long as it but from the moment that it starts to coincide with inequality, with justice and hardship, you can almost say that it spells the beginning of the end of power and influence of big societies.
In researching the book, has it made you feel like periods of peace inevitably follow periods of war and vice versa? Is there a way to ever buck the trend, or is that just human nature?
Well, if, for instance, we look back to classical thinkers about power, like Sun Tzu, for instance, in China, Kautilya in India, which we all discuss in the book, but also poets and writers like Hesiod, they all seem to assume that we have a cycle, that we have a cycle of rise and fall of societies, but that we also have a cycle of peace and war in international politics. So indeed, if you draw from history and if you reread those strategic thinkers, there is a tendency to get a little bit cynical. And as an author, I must confess that by having gone through this history, it's often a fight against cynicism. Do we accept that today we are inching closer to a period of fraying of the global order, of war and of conflict? I'm a child of an age of globalization. I like the traveling. I like the borderless world. So that's the kind of future that I do not like to reconcile myself with. But that's a reason to more, I think, to try to learn from history and to try to understand what actually causes major wars, what causes the fraying of globalization and openness. And I think this understanding is absolutely critical, not only to preserve the position of our own society, but also to try to at least a little bit preserve this openness and this optimism that used to characterize us in the past.
We've talked about, and you in the book, about the need to defend those kind of core values of continued diplomacy, of liberalism, of human rights. And is it right? I mean, you've you know, worked in Brussels for a long time as well. And is it right to say that potentially driving some of the negotiating strategy when it comes to Brexit is not just a kind of economic, trying to preserve economic good fortune, but also this kind of political belief about that a stand has to be taken against people who want to break up these kinds of unions because it's something that's important to preserve as a liberal value? Do you think that's driving negotiators to be tougher with countries like Britain?
Definitely so. One of the big historical lessons that at least I drew from researching for doing the research for the book is that power as such is not enough. If you disconnect power from ideals and beliefs and values, you're lost. Again, one of the examples that I give in this work is, for instance, this ancient Indian thinker Kautilya, who advised the Indian Maurya emperor. What he says is, power is the means, but happiness and dignity is the ends. And that, I think, is something very important and perhaps also makes us understand better what the European Union's agenda is towards the United Kingdom. Yes, we want to preserve our economic power and to advance our economic interest, hence the discussion about customs union and so forth. But the market that we have built up with a lot of sweat and effort and sacrifice, to some degree, is also a reflection of who we are. The European market, I think, stands for a package of social values, environmental values that we want to uphold and want to defend. And we don't want it to be hollowed out by countries that are somewhat on the fringes, but have the liberty to negotiate with other powers, China, for instance, the United States, trade agreements that go beyond the standards that we set for ourselves. So it's absolutely critical for Europe, the European Union, but I think also independent and individual European nations like the United Kingdom to try to defend in any possible way those standards, those values that we have advanced and propagated over generations. Because if we neglect to do so, I think we are sacrificing and giving up a very important legacy of previous generations, and I would see that inching close to a crime even in this big sweep of world politics.
Jonathan, thank you very much. And Jonathan's book, A Political History of the World, is out now from Pelican. That's all for this week. My thanks to all my other guests, Michael White, Katie Balls and John Crace. The producer was Simon Barnard. I'm Jessica Elgott. Thank you for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.